Hey everybody, I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Hey everybody, I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond.
Today's episode starts with a trigger warning as we talk about subjects that are sensitive and linked to sexual assault as well as incest. Remember to take a pause and practice self-care when listening to any episode, whether it's here or someplace else that focuses on mental health. It's always important to take care of yourself first. Okay, let's start our episode.
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. Happy Monday. Now, you might be listening to this podcast and think, well, it's not Monday. So here in Minnesota, it's Monday. And I got to tell you something, guys, the weather is still winter. So, of course, what are we doing today? We're connecting with some of our friends from the Great White North, aka Canada. And today's guest, I'm really excited to bring him on because in addition to having so much knowledge about consciousness, subconsciousness, where are we going in the field of psychotherapy? How are we helping others with trauma as well as ourselves? I mean, dating back for 40 years, it's a lot of wisdom, right? To jam pack in. And I do want to mention real quick that we're going to be doing two other podcasts. So in addition to listening today, you better, you know, stay tuned, subscribe. Why? Because you want to know when we're going to have our guest on again in two other sessions. This person, like I mentioned, is a practitioner of over 40 years, an accomplished author, and has many different books. He has a pen name, which is T. Wilton Dale, and goes by Wilton. So everybody, let's give a heartfelt PTSD and Beyond welcome. Wilton, welcome to PTSD and Beyond.
Hey, thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you on. And it's no surprise to our listeners how we connect with people. And one way is through social media. And you've been posting things on Twitter that have resonated, that have had me pause. Before we recorded, guys, I was mentioning to Wilton that he's already in my subconscious mind because there's a lot of Star Trek references. And I can't help, of course, you know, I'm putting my makeup on, I'm doing stuff over the weekend, and I'm reflecting on our other conversation from last week. And so we've connected through social media, which is really great because there's always something about when you see what somebody posts that can really touch you in many different ways. It can either get a response that makes you say, you know what, I want to think about that, or I want to respond to this, but I want to take a pause moment and process it. And then reaching out and saying, hey, would you like to be on the podcast? Because what you talk about, I think our listeners would really want to hear about this. And today we're going to talk about observations in the field. And that is something that is really new to do.
I'm excited about doing this as well. And I'm now retired. I've been retired for getting close to 3 years now, which is giving me a good chance to reflect back on what happened during my career. My career spanned 42 years, and this is giving me a good chance to look back on it and to think about it again without being embedded in it.
Yeah.
But to have that sense of being able to look at what the trends were rather than being caught up in what we were doing at that particular time, but looking at the trends over time. And so I'm hoping we can talk about some of those trends. And when we connect the next time in talking about my first novel, we will really get into it because that novel was based on projecting the current trends into the future in a dystopian novel. So,
right.
But today, I would like to reflect on changes that happened that brought into awareness for me the issue of childhood trauma and how that affects adult mental health. And I want to start with a story. And the story goes back a long ways in time, probably to the late 70s. And I'm a very young, very naive mental health professional in a rural mental health clinic in Eastern Ontario. And a woman comes to me and tells me a story that took great courage for her to tell. She told the story of father-daughter incest. And I was absolutely disoriented by the story. I knew that incest occurred, but there was nothing in my education or training that equipped me at all to help someone who was troubled by it happening in her own life. And so I went to a supervisor. I had a really good supervisor. I went to a supervisor and I said to him, this person has told me this. How do I help her? And he looked at me and he said, father-daughter incest, that's really rare. I've never had a case of that. And then he said, let's look it up to see how common it is. So now we're looking it up back in the 70s. And what he found out was the estimated incidence of that was about 1 in 10,000. That's what it was considered back then.
Wow.
And so he gave me some really good advice. He said, you listen carefully and attentively to that story. And then he gave me the wrong reason for doing so. He said, you might never hear another case of this in your entire professional career. I want to zip ahead from there, because about 10 years later, I was sitting on a team of mental health professionals. We were a small team, about 10 people. We had to review our cases in front of each other. Great. I'm now living and working in Alberta. And one of the members of the team kept bringing to our awareness that we should be looking at the histories of childhood trauma in the clients that we were serving. Now, our team was very rooted in a very medical approach to mental health problems. So we were, you know, diagnosing anxiety, depression, psychosis, that sort of thing, personality disorders. It was not at all trauma informed at that stage as we are now. And she was kind of like a lone voice on her team, and everybody just sort of tolerated her. Her name was June. But it started to fit with me that we began to recognize that there was something missing in this very medical approach that the team was taking. And so one of the things that I did at that stage was that I started to work towards certification as a clinical member with the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapists, which gave me a much broader view of current relationship and mental health distress rooted in the context of family. The other thing that changed at that point, there was a very seminal book that came out, I think it was in the late 80s, called The Courage to Heal by, what were the names? Ellen Bass and Laura Davis. I think those were the names that wrote that book. And upon reading it and the influence of June, I started to do groups for women who had been sexually molested as children in our community. I worked together with the director of the local women's shelter in order to run those groups. Within a few years after that, I had gone into private practice, and I began to work with an agency that dealt specifically with childhood sexual abuse. And I became the primary practitioner in my community to do play therapy with children who had been sexually abused. So I was right embedded in the entire issue. All of those changes happened over a period of about 15 years.
Wow.
And we're now 25, 30 years later, and we have come to a point where looking at things from a trauma-informed perspective is much more common. We have therapies that are growing up around that perspective.
Yep.
And so I got to witness a sea change over the course of my short career. And if we go back to think about it, that estimate of incidence of 1 in 10,000
yeah.
that we had back in the late 70s really demonstrates an enormous avoidance and denial of a very significant problem that arises and affects a number of people. The population studies, the one that was done in Canada in the 90s, identified roughly 30% of children have been sexually abused. And I don't know what the current incident figures are. I'm not keeping up with that literature, but we do know that it is a common problem and has a really pronounced effect on adult mental health functioning.
Yep.
And so I felt when you look back on the whole story, there has been an enormous change that has happened, which creates in my mind, how did we get it so wrong back then? And the other provocative question is, how are we getting it wrong now? And we have this sense that our current level of knowledge and skill and perspective, well, we finally got it right.
Right. That's actually true, you know, and what's interesting that I'm wondering is the original person who was overseeing, you know, the lead practitioner who made the claim that this is very rare, you know, was there any follow-up with that person ever, even, you know, later in the future to go back and say, hey, remember when we had this case and you made the statement that this is very rare, you know, listen and pay attention, listen carefully, right? Because you're most likely not going to experience a case like this ever again, to go back to that person and say, actually, it is more common than what we originally thought. Or for a practitioner to then, you know, consult and advise another practitioner with approaching a case with this mindset. Was there any follow-up with this person at all? Do you know what they're doing today?
I know where they are. He's a number of years older than I am, and I'm already old. And so I think he's kind of long gone from interest in the profession. I lost touch with him. Although I will say that he still sits on my left shoulder. He had a great sense of humor, so often he laughs at me for my foolishness. And I've carried him with me as a mentor for my entire career. And I want to say how much I value his, you listen very carefully. And with that, I think there was also the sense of not only for your own curiosity, but also out of respect for the story that this woman had to courageously bring this forward to this young male mental health professional that she happened to see.
Right.
And he was a fairly strong humanist, although I don't think we were using the term back then. I think back then in the early stages, you know, we were aware of the concept of client-centered therapy, you know, arising from Carl Rogers' work. And I think he was quite rooted in that and has influenced me a great deal ever since. What I want to say about this is our capacity to get things wrong in this profession. And it has made me think about, how are we getting it wrong now?
Yeah.
And that is a scary thought. When we talk the next time about my first novel, where we look at what mental health practice looks like 40 years in the future, there is a bit of a dystopian tale about how it is approached at that point, which is a bit of, most dystopians are cautionary tales. I won't get into that too much. One of the things that worries me over the course of my career, we have pursued what is called empirically supported therapies. And in a sense, that's a good thing, because it has gotten scientists looking at what we do and looking at it objectively. but it has also limited us a great deal.
For the person who's listening right now, can you just, you know, give a real quick snippet on what is that? What does that actually mean, empirically supported therapy?
So an empirically supported therapy is a therapy that can be operationalized into a particular protocol, and that protocol can be compared to who gets that particular type of therapy versus who gets a different protocol. And then the specific protocols of therapy that do better, then we accept those as being the ones that we should be doing.
Right. Like a DBT, a CBT, EMDR, yes. Like the phrases yes. that people, okay. I just yeah. want to put that out there because there might be somebody who's listening sure. saying, oh, I want to know what that is. And so thank you so much for clarifying.
Oh, it's okay. What I'm concerned about though, is that that limits us to only accepting therapies that can be reduced to a protocol
yeah.
that can be then applied to individuals in clinics or labs as being, you know, clearly following that particular type of therapy. Mm-hmm. And it raises the question when we reduce the interaction, the psychotherapy interaction to a protocol, what do we lose? And we lose that sense of intuition, that sense of emotional connection,
yep.
because we begin to be focusing on the what the steps in the protocol and the client's responses only in terms of those steps in the protocol. I think you mentioned Diana Troy a few minutes ago for our Star Trek fans.
Yes.
And what we noticed in Diana Troy, she was an empath
right.
in the Star Trek theory. And she had the sense of being able to understand the emotional status of the individuals that she was talking to.
Right.
And brought that in as being a primary consideration in the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were talking last week, Deb, you mentioned the holographic doctor that's
right.
on the Enterprise theory.
The doctor, right.
Yeah, the doctor.
They couldn't come up with a name for him, you know, they just called him the doctor.
Yeah, yeah. The holographic doctor, I think he was, which identifies, yes, that trend towards only doing it according to algorithms and only right. doing it according to established scientific knowledge. And that is the thing that I became concerned about over the course of my career, that we were shifting in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that you mentioned, and we were talking about empirically supported therapy, you named off a number of them, CBT, DBT, EMDR. I call them the Scrabble letter therapies. And there, over the course of my career, there became this great proliferation of these. When I began my career, there were only three different types of therapies. There was behavior therapy, there was psychoanalytic therapy, and there was client-centered therapy. Gestalt therapy was just emerging at the beginning of my career. And then we've gotten, over the course of the decades that I practiced, dozens of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of them that we just refer to them by letters, which kind of makes it that you have to be one of the initiated to understand.
Right.
It takes it away from, you know, when we talked about behavior therapy, you used to know was focusing on behavior. Or if we talked about psychoanalytic, it was about analyzing the internal psychological structures of the individual. Whereas now we've just got all these Scrabble letter therapies and we compete them against each other in trials. And so they're trying to take out their status as being, we're the best at.
Right.
Which seems really foolish to me. I think what we need to recognize, and over the course of my career, I became more and more aware of how complex human emotional functioning is, and often how ambiguous it is. And so all of our therapies have wanted to make it very simple. You know, it's just about this one particular thing. And if we correct this one particular thing, we're going to be okay.
Right.
And have made it wanting to be very clear. So, you know, we do symptom checklists or those sorts of things in order to be, well, we have to be really clear what we're treating here. So that's a trend that has disturbed me over the course of my career. But I do want to say, as I talk about this, being really encouraged by something that happened towards the end of my career. So at the beginning of my career, I think I was very much in the client-centered therapy perspective, the Carl Rogers perspective, empathetic listening, the sense of validating what a client said, and connecting with them on a respectful emotional level. But late in my career, I began to read just about everything I could by Daniel Siegel, and an area that he identifies as interpersonal neurobiology,
right,
which talks about how we can hook up with other people on a deeply emotional and intuitive level. And now, you know, there's a bit of a sense of protocol around what he does and how he does things. But I think it has brought us back to the fact that it is about relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am encouraged at this point, you know, when I look back to say, hey, we're moving in a different direction. And with trauma-centered therapy, with bringing back emotions as being what we focus on in therapy, with knowing that the therapeutic relationship is ultimately the most important factor,
mm-hmm.
Then I think we have stepped away from some of the objectification that I saw at the middle part of my career.
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And I hope that you're truly enjoying today's podcast episode. If you'd like more information about what PTSD and Beyond is, what we do, the services that we provide, our workshops, our training, our keynotes, and our coaching, drop us a line at hello@PTSDandBeyond.org. All right, let's continue on with today's episode.
You know, some of the things that you bring up here, there's a distinction between doing something that's almost transactional and task-oriented and very methodical, right?
Yes.
It's very sterile. It completely removes the emotional component. So if we use, again, Star Trek as the example here, and a major shout out to our Star Trek community within our PTSD and Beyond community, because we're going to talk about some deep layers. And if you haven't watched the Enterprise series, do it, because then you'll be like, oh my gosh, look at all these things. And yes, that does apply. So where I'm going with this is, we have the doctor who's a holographic doctor, right? And how many times in Enterprise does a case come up and the doctor has this facial expression of dismay? Like, he's stumped, right? And as well as with Data, right? So Picard gives Data something, and Data's, you know, you can see it in, you know, Brent Spiner's facial expressions, who I just want to say that I've had the pleasure of meeting. Okay. I'm going to totally show my geeky side here. Anyway, yes. Yes. I'm the mother that took the kids out of school and drove to Kansas City for a Comic-Con because everybody but Sir Patrick Stewart was there.
Oh my God.
Once in a lifetime situation. Now we're getting in the van and we're driving. At the time I had a van. Yes. Okay. Anyway, getting back to the point here. So then we have Data, right? Who is this super intelligent android, right? And mm-hmm. you can see it again in Brent Spiner's face, you know, doing these, trying these calculations and whatever, and it doesn't work out. So we have two super human technology, things that we can't even contemplate today, right? Back in the day, if we think about it, you know, we had, the Jetsons, right? And people thought, oh my gosh, look at, you know, Judy's talking to her mom on this video screen. Well, now we're doing that. So who's to say this isn't going to become a reality, meaning this, meaning data and the doctor. And yet the thing that trumps, as in the cards, not as in the person, I'm going to clarify there, that, you know, invalidates, if you will, all of the logic is human emotion. And again, there's no such thing as coincidence, because I send myself text messages of things that I think about while I'm getting ready for the day. And this is what I wrote. Today I wrote, logic doesn't cure emotional distress. So then I thought to myself, okay, well, if logic doesn't do it, because we know all these things, you know, our therapist, we can read a book who's about DBT, CBT, EMDR, all these, you know, therapies, and here's the protocol to do it. Here are the steps. And if you do this, right, or train your brain and positive thinking, and I'm not saying it doesn't work. What I am saying is that if it was as effective as it's being touted, then wouldn't things look a bit different for society? I think it would, as well as people's individual lives. So I wrote to myself because I was thinking, well, what is then the antidote? And one of the things that I hear you saying is relationships.
Yes.
Relationship with yourself, relationship with community, relationship with your therapist. And then also emotions. How do we validate our emotions, even if somebody else is saying, but that's not what happened? And my argument would be, meaning my follow-up to the person who's saying, but that's not what happened, that's what's real for this person. So how do we validate it? How do we connect with that person? Bear with me here, because I do have a point. The point I always come back to myself, and I've said this time and time again, that love is the antidote to pain and suffering. Love is the antidote to emotional distress. And love can be, say, in the workplace, I know that my boss cares about me. I feel it. It is a feeling. It's how we feel. You can be around somebody and they can say it in a kind way. You know what? I really like you a lot. I really like you. Or, you know what? That outfit looks great. Or, you know what? You did a great job. But do you feel it? Because if you don't feel it, there is no emotional connection. The relationship isn't going to then be the one that is going to help the situation for both the person who's delivering the message as well as the person receiving it.
I'm so with you on this, Deb. And as you were talking, the thought came to mind, as I worked with trauma, occasionally I saw people that had been in like in a car accident and, you know, had injuries from it, that sort of thing. But most of the trauma that I dealt with was trauma that one human being did to another human being. I worked for a long time, about 10 years on a military base, and was dealing with military trauma. And of course they saw a lot of awful things. But one of the huge amounts of trauma was how they felt about the officers' decisions that put them in those positions. And that was an interpersonal trauma. If we're dealing with trauma that arises from relationship, I think the only antidote to that is healthy relationship. And in a therapeutic relationship, obviously, we need to be very careful not to do any harm. So we ensure there are very good boundaries in that relationship, so that we don't exploit our clients and we don't use our clients for our own benefits. But at the same token, within those boundaries, we need to have a genuine human relationship that has that capacity of love. I was baffled often in the when I was working as a therapist in how my clients spoke of that in relationship with me. And they frequently said, it's like I have a very good friend. And that was kind of scary for me as a psychologist because, you know, we're not supposed to be rent a friend. And, you know, I probably shouldn't confess that that's the way, but that was the only term that they could have for the quality of relationship that we had, that sense of loyalty and intent on their well-being that was part of the therapeutic relationship. Now, I had to be very careful, of course.
Right.
And I didn't socialize with clients.
Yep.
I made it very clear that we were going to keep our relationship to just the work that we were doing in the professional context. But that was the way they could describe it.
Right.
Because I was in practice so long, I often had people come back to me that hadn't seen me for 10 years or 15 years. And when they would come back, I would often be surprised because they had to do some work to actually find me again, that sort of thing. And so I, you know, I'd say to them, you know, it's a long time since I've seen you. Why did you want to come back to me? And invariably, except for one situation, so I have to be clear about it. Well, the sentence always started, when I was with you, you made me feel,
mm-hmm.
and then they would say safe or listened to respected.
Right.
And that told me that no matter what I did in terms of the protocol of therapy that I happened to use, whether or not I did the EMDR or hypnosis or, you know, whatever it happened to be, because I was trained in those protocols, what was most important to them was the quality of relationship that they had with me. That's what brought them back again to me years later. And when we look at competence, we look at it, did you do a certification in that treatment that you're using?
Right.
We never look at competence in terms of how good are you at forming that relationship that will allow the healing from other traumatic relationships.
Exactly. The competence, so the other question that people will get asked, at least I love it, not really love it, but when I go to a conference and you're wearing your badge, usually the conference will put underneath your name where you received your education. And so my education is an EDD versus a PhD. So my work is applied in the mm-hmm. field rather than clinical. And on occasion, you know, there's the regala of the, well, PhD versus EDD and whatever. And then it has happened a few times with people at conferences, you know, they'll say, oh, you have an EDD. And then they look to see, oh, you went to the University of St. Thomas, which has, you know, it's a respected school. So there are all of these layers of what makes you competent over someone else, whether it's or how many times have you been published? Where have you been published? You know what? In the grand scheme of things, that doesn't really matter when you're helping somebody with trauma. The person who needs assistance with trauma, they rely on the person to have gone and gotten education and to be trained. But like in any field, therapy and psychotherapy and helping people is in this factor are not immune from a person can have the credentials as well as the education, but not be effective in developing those relationships. And I have a question here that I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on the difference of a nurturing relationship versus a healthy relationship. Because these two, I want to call them labels, but these two distinctions are being discussed about. No, the way that trauma is going to be addressed that is going to be effective is through a nurturing relationship. And then other people are saying, actually, no, it's a healthy relationship. Mm-hmm. So, you know, can you share with us a little bit about what your thoughts are on that school of thought about nurturing versus healthy? And perhaps maybe healthy encompasses nurturing.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think nurturing is one of the components of healthy, but it can't be the only one. And there has to be a sense of when we help the client to self-nurture rather right. than us doing the nurture for them.
Right.
I think it, often in the early stages when people come to us and their resilience is so low and their capacity to cope and is very compromised, we do have to nurture them. As the relationship develops, as with in parenting, we move away from having to do all the nurturing and have our kids learn how to take care of themselves. And so I think it's one component, and it probably is one component at one phase of the of therapy, so that we need to be good at it. But I don't think it can be the whole thing. And that's what I struggle with, is the tendency right now for people to say, this thing that I'm doing is the right thing to do and is the only right thing to do.
Right.
And I think that we, as long as we maintain boundaries to keep everything really safe for our clients so that they're not exploited, they're not intruded upon, they're not taken advantage of for our own particular emotional needs, then we have to be flexible in terms of what does our client need right now. And in terms of that, the other thing that I wanted to say, we've talked a little bit about the research into psychotherapy. When I got into the field, the relationship that practicing psychologists had with science was that we were to be little scientists, that we were to be good observers, that we were to develop hypotheses as to what was the phenomenon that we were engaged with was involved with that, test those out, be willing to look at the results of what we did and make, be willing to acknowledge our mistakes and do it better.
Right. Yeah.
There was that notion of science where we were actively engaged scientifically. Our minds were, and you know, we were critically thinking about our own interface with the phenomena that we were engaged with. We lost that because suddenly the science of psychotherapy became about what journal articles you've read,
right,
and whether or not you're practicing the current trend in terms of what therapy is being done for what phenomenon.
Yeah, I'm laughing not because it's funny, but because how many times do we do a literature review or somebody will say, well, that article's old. So, you know, I look on my bookshelf and I collect vintage psychotherapy, you know, psychology books, and I find, and I like it when the previous owner has written, you know, in the margins, because I write in the margins of my books too. Think, okay, who's going to get all these, right? There is a wisdom of yesteryear. It's not that it's invalidated. There is a wisdom of yesteryear that sometimes gets pushed to the side. And then all of a sudden we have things that emerge like, what's that guy? Laughing. Scott Barry Kaufman, no disrespect out there, Dr. Kaufman, who repurposes Maslow's stuff, right? And so everybody's like, oh my gosh, no, I have Abraham Maslow's complete works on my bookshelf.
Yes.
It was given as a gift. I'm laughing because it's repurposed. It's not new. Herbert Benson, the stress relaxation response. I got two copies. Why? One, because I write in it because the other person's written in it. And the other one, because that was given to me too. And it's a pristine copy. And I just keep it there because it looks nice. But the point of the matter is, it's not that new things can't be developed. It's that we can't invalidate the stuff that was wisdom from people who paved the way. We need to still acknowledge those folks, because if it wasn't for Hans Seeley, Would we really know what stress does to the body in his experiments? And again, no disrespect to Dr. Vanderkalk, body keeps the score. I do think there's a respect and a recognition to say, hey, you know what? I took this person's work and I thought about it and it resonated with me to the point where I'm doing more with it, right? Mm-hmm. I'm continuing it on. So when I look at, you know, Dr. Patakos and Dr. Wong, you know, both mentees of Viktor Frankl, they openly say, you know, we're carrying on his legacy because it spoke to me that much. Meaning and purpose spoke to me that much. Meaning and purpose with grief and grieving and how to overcome that. What does it look like? You know, and again, it's both about the human connection. Mm-hmm. Using even ethnography, right? Connecting with our heritage in different cultures. Instead of saying there's one thing and only one thing to do, because then we really get into a danger area of doing harm because we're so myopic in practice and protocol that we miss the purpose and the intent of doing this work.
You bring me back to something that I did want to say. When we look at the harm that people do to each other, which is, you know, at the root of complex PTSD. It is about one person imposing their protocol on another person, having the power to get that other person to do what fits within their mind they want to have done. When we look at therapies that focus on protocol rather than person, we reenact the same problem. And so what happens is that the therapist becomes so intent on these are the steps that I need to go through in order to help you. So there's an imposition of that protocol, which is parallel to the imposition of the protocol of the person who harmed them. So I think we really need to be careful around the, I think the discoveries, you know, like I trained in EMDR, I think the discoveries of EMDR are quite fascinating. I also trained in hypnosis, which has a much longer history of wisdom associated with it. Mm-hmm. I think we can look at those things as being that gives us insight. And that gives us an awareness of things to look for and maybe some things that we can do, but we can't lose sight of the client that's in front of us as we do those things. What I get disturbed by is when somebody will take a particular therapy and it's the hammer they have that turns everything into the nail. That they always hit. And so, you know, I hope we're getting wiser about it. I was reflecting on how young our profession is, Deb. That, you know, we basically have about 100 years. If you push it back to William James, we have about 150 years that we've been around. And one of the We think that, hey, we're at the point where we know so much. And yet we're very early in this process.
Yep.
And the blight of youth is bravado. And we know, you know, and I, you know, now that I'm in my seventh decade, I recognize that there is a gentleness of wisdom that comes. That's wholly different than bravado of, hey, we now know the right thing, or we have the right procedure, or we have the right answer for this.
Right.
And so, you know, as I reflect back on my career, I hope that people will recognize that we can do things, but we really need to be that wise and present and well-intentioned and careful and respectful individual beside the individual that's hurting. That is the fundamental role of the psychotherapist.
I really like exactly what you're saying here, and I think it's a great segue to move to concluding our session and our time together today, that we can do things and, you know, that are being wise and being present and being respectful and being beside the individual that is hurting.
Right. Yes. And that's essentially, I think, what humans need is they need that sense of presence beside. I was very privileged in my career that I got to spend an hour at a time with individuals, which gave long enough that I didn't just have to take ratings of symptoms and I didn't have to dispense a therapy. I could take long enough to be with them. And the practice of applied psychology is wonderful in that it does give us that time to establish relationship and to have that relationship recurring so that we can keep coming back to that individual and we can track with them. So anyway, those are some observations from the course of about 42 years of practicing as a mental health professional.
And many beautiful stories, many, many beautiful stories. And I can't thank you enough for being here with us today, Wilton. And thank you for the person who's still present. If there's one last thing that you'd like to share with our listeners today, what would that be?
Celebrate being human. It's far more important than being trained.
That's a great quote. Celebrate being human. It's far greater than being trained. Thank you again so much for being here today, Wilton.
Awesome. I really loved our discussion. It's been great fun, and I look forward to the ones that we've got coming up.
I know. We've got a couple more coming up, and yes. I appreciate the people that are here today, too. Thank you so much for being with us. I know that you guys know that our sessions and our podcasts always drop every Friday. Make sure that you hit the subscribe button, because when you do, you'll get that actually episode a day early. And if you feel so inclined, please do so. Support us with our Ko-fi account. Buy us a cup of coffee. You know how much I love it. As well as think about being a sponsor on Patreon, and we'll keep bringing our episodes to you. So again, Wilton, thank you so much for being here and being present with all of us today, as well as our fabulous listeners. And I think we're up to 98 countries now globally. We can always keep track, and I know we've added a couple others. So thank you again so much, guys. And you guys make it a good one. We'll see you again next week.